Good morning, good morning, good morning. And thank you for joining me on the Roundtable Talk Show. I am your host, Sharifa Hardy, and I have a very special show for you today. Every day we do the Roundtable Talk Show. We sit down with experts in their field. We talk about what's going on in the world. We have a natural, organic conversation. But today we're going to do something different. We have a very special show with a very special guest, Dr. Howard Rankin. But before I go ahead and introduce Dr. Rankin, like I said, this is a special show. So I'm going to ask you to do what I always ask you to do, and that is to go out and be an evangelist for the Roundtable Talk Show. Today's show especially, someone is going to need to hear the information that we have. Maybe they're an author. Maybe they're publishing their first book. Maybe they're just thinking about publishing their book. Maybe they're starting out in business. Maybe they're on their journey and they don't know where to go. But I guarantee you today's guest is going to bring the information that is going to be able to assist them, but they won't have the information unless you go ahead and share the show with them. So send that tweet, make that post, send an email, send a text, but let them know we are live on the Roundtable Talk Show. So I want to go ahead and introduce my guest, Dr. Howard Rankin. He has extensive expertise and knowledge in the areas of psychology, neuroscience, and neurotechnology. He is also an experienced speaker, best-selling and award-winning author, and host of the podcast, How Not to Think. Dr. Rankin has written 12 books in his own name, co-written another 9, and ghost-written 30 others, all nonfiction. Good morning, Dr. Rankin. How are you?
I'm very well and honored to be on your show, Sharifa. Thank you so much.
I am honored to have you. So tell us about yourself. Who are you? What do you do? And what are you passionate about?
Oh, okay. Well, I have a background in psychology for a long time. I practiced psychology, introduced neuroscience at some point into that career. So that was interesting. More latterly, I've gone into writing and spreading the word about the things that I think are important in life and that in this culture that we have today, we really need to understand and change. And so that's writing books and helping other people tell their stories about important topics. One of the things that I've been interested in the recent past was how we really think, and we can justify almost anything. And so I wrote a book called I Think, Therefore I'm Wrong, which, you know, is a little cynical in the title, a little bit of a joke there, but it's also some truth in that we now know that we're not really logical. We go on intuition, on the things that we want. We select, we pick the things we want. We're biased in that sense. The brain actually is designed to make us biased because it, for simplicity, divides it up into it's either this or that. And that binary thinking is just too simplistic in a complicated world. So that's what I do.
But do you feel, because I know I feel that society as a whole is changing. We were brought up, at least I was brought up, to kind of go away from your emotions. I was that child in the family where my family was like, Sharifa, you are just too emotional. You are so dramatic. You know, I always had these emotions. So I always felt that I had to hide my emotions and just focus on the logic. Now what I hear, especially over the last 14, 15 months or so during this global pandemic, where more people are leaning towards that, well, what do you feel? How are you feeling? And tapping into more of the emotional IQ than just the logic.
Yeah. And of course, emotions are a huge part of our thinking. Memories are much more reinforced when there's an emotion attached to them. We're much more likely to pay attention to things that catch our emotion. The challenge is, emotions are really important. I personally don't think there's such a thing as a negative emotion. There might be uncomfortable ones, for sure, but an emotion is telling you something. And then what you have to do, ideally, is to detach the emotion and then address the problem that's created that in the first place. And unfortunately, we don't seem to be doing that. We seem to be just expressing things angrily or in a frustrated way. And the problem with that, from a communication perspective, is it's not very effective. It's not very effective. You know, shouting and screaming and yelling, and I understand people are very frustrated, they're very angry. It actually isn't very effective in convincing other people about your situation. And so that's the challenge is, yeah, emotions are important, but what are they saying? And we have to do that to get underneath that and resolve that problem. Aristotle, one of my friends, said that anyone can be angry, but being angry with the right person for the right reason, for the right amount of time in the right way, that's a challenge. And it is.
I understand that it's a challenge, but what do you recommend? Because what this is so interesting to me, because it reminds me of a conversation that my father and I have all the time, you know, because I'll be angry about something and he's like, no, you know, watch the anger and all that. Mm-hmm. And I will say, I believe in righteous anger. I believe that there are situations that so many people just, you know, it's not my problem. I don't have anything to do with it. I don't want to get involved. And I'm like, more people should be angry. One of my favorite expressions is Edmund Burke. All that is necessary for evil to succeed is for good men to do nothing. And that to me is about anger. It's like, if you don't get upset, if you don't get mad, then guess what? People will continue to do whatever it is that they're doing. So I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, well, so anger comes on the perception that you're being treated unfairly or somebody's being treated unfairly and there's injustice. And that's totally justified. The question then becomes, how do you then change that situation, right? So the anger might be a great motivator for you to say, I need to change a situation, right? But using anger, you'd really have to use it very strategically. And a lot of the time, I don't see people doing that. I see, you know, either sides of the political spectrum on any issue that they're passionate about, they're yelling and screaming, and I understand that, but it's got to go beyond that. Because if you're really trying to get people to, who don't understand the injustice, you really try to engage them, that isn't ultimately the way to do it, or not in the long term, maybe initially, but then you say, okay, we have to do that. So certainly anger, injustice is great motivation, but then it becomes, how do you convey that message in the most effective way? And, you know, with these groups, whoever they are across the spectrum, you're angry, it makes you feel good, it makes your supporters feel good, but what does it do to the people who are, as you said, you know, neutral, don't understand, you know, haven't been exposed to this. Most people hearing anger, 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 probably are just going to say, no, you know, it turns them off. So at some point you do have to put that anger aside and think more, I think, strategically. And honestly, the great leaders of this century or of the last century, you know, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, Mahatma Gandhi, all said that. All said, it's not, don't, violent protests don't work. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence that the most effective protests are in fact nonviolent. And so that's part of the strategy.
No, I hear you. I hear you. And I definitely agree with you on that point. I just don't feel that just because someone is angry, they necessarily have to yell. They necessarily have to scream. They necessarily have to be violent. But no, I believe absolutely. It's the anger that motivates them to take some sort of action. Because if they're not angry about it, if they're not upset by it, if they're not bothered by it, then it will just continue and the world just basically goes on as is.
Yes. And the distinction we need to make here is, as I say, anger comes on the perception of injustice and unfairness. And that's very important, okay? So that anger is a huge marker. It's gonna put your attention there. That is important to me. But after that, how you use anger or don't use it, I think is important, depending on exactly what the issue is. Yes, to initially arouse that sense of injustice, but then in trying to communicate, then you have to think more strategically about how are you going to get this across to people who don't understand it, aren't exposed to it, et cetera, et cetera.
But I also think we learn from generations to generations for, you know, For example, Dr. Rankin, I'll give you my family. If you met anyone in my family, like my immediate family, my mom and dad, they're basically the same. They're really into astrology. They would sit you down and be like, Dr. Rankin, what's your sign? You know, and that's how they are. So I'm an Aries. My grandmother was an Aries. So they would always be like, yeah, you know, you're just like your grandmother. And so my grandmother's known for this conversation. Someone said to her one time, they said, you know, your voice is like taking a brick and throwing it through a pane glass window. You know what I mean? It's that sound. And my grandmother's response was, sometimes that's what it takes to get people's attention. And so seeing her be this loud, explosive woman that everyone thought was angry, and then, you know, being married and having my ex-husband tell me, you know, Sharifa, it's your delivery. You know, over time, I had to work on the delivery of the message, because if I'm upset about something, if I'm angry about something and I'm dealing with that emotion, it just kind of explodes. But I'm like, you know, 45 now, just made 45 in March. I'm a grown woman now. I've learned to kind of deliver the message in a way, like they say, putting a spoonful of sugar in the medicine. So would you say that's part of it?
Yes, absolutely. And welcome to the Aries Club, too. That's great. Yeah, I think it's important. You know, interestingly, in my career as a psychologist, I've been a psychologist for like 20 years. And I realized that no one had ever given me or exposed me to training in how to effectively communicate. Mm-hmm. Which is staggering, given that a large part of that job is trying to communicate to people the changes and why they need to change and so forth. And so I wrote a book called Power Talk, The Art of Effective Communication, which is still so relevant that I recently brought out a second edition. And that book really highlights the things you really need to do to get people's attention. And what it is you have to take your lead from them as to who they are, right? What is going to resonate with them? Right. And that is the mark of an effective communicator who knows the audience, knows the person, and can structure the communication so the person is engaged and is much more likely to own it. Because let's face it, just telling people, don't work. Getting them to own it is huge.
You know, I don't know, Dr. Rankin, if you do any work with relationships and marriage or anything like that. But one of the things that I've found, especially being divorced twice and hoping to do it again, is that their family itself, their communication styles are a lot different. And I didn't realize this until I was older. So my mother has 8 brothers and sisters. So they never got a lot of time, raised by a single mom, didn't really talk, you know, that wasn't they're more of, they speak very short sentences, I guess, right? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to find a word to explain it. There's not a lot of talking in that side of the family. Then you have my father, you know, smaller family, 2 sisters, 2 brothers, but they're from New York City. And if you went to my dad's family's house for Sunday dinner, there's a lot of yelling. There's a lot of screaming. There's a lot of, you know, and you'd be like, oh my God, are these people arguing? Are they about to fight? And it's like, no, they're not mad. That's just the way they communicate.
They're just passionate, right?
Yes.
And you know, again, that's okay, everyday life. But if in your job or in the purpose and meaning of the expression of that, you are trying to get somebody to own something, an idea or whatever, then you have to be more strategic about it. And I think this is something that people don't understand. It's amazing to me that there simply aren't more courses on effective communication. I'm creating one right now because people just say they talk from their own position. And I understand that. But if your goal is really trying to influence somebody, you've got to be more strategic than that. Now, with your family, with your dad's family, they own you, this is how they communicate, and this is how that's fine. They're probably not trying to convince them. But if you're in customer service, for example, that probably wouldn't work terribly well, mm-hmm. right? or anything where you are trying to get somebody to own a message. It's you've got to engage them. You've got to make it meaningful to them. And it's amazing what happens when you do that. Amazing. I got a great story here, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
There's a famous psychiatrist called Milt Erickson. And he was well known for understanding that if you attack people head on, the defenses go up and you're done. Mm-hmm. And so one day he had a woman present to him, and she was very frigid. She thought sex was horrible, evil, terrible. And what he found out was that her mother died when she was 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And her mother had said to her, sex is evil, terrible, and what have you. Now, the typical person hearing that would say, oh, come on, your mom was just, you know, weird. She was wacky. But Erickson knew that if he said that, she would reject the message because her mother was glorified because she had died at a young age. So what Erickson said was, your mom was right. She was right. Sex is evil, wrong, terrible when you're 11 years old. Unfortunately, she didn't live long enough to give you the 15-year-old message about sex and the 20-year-old and the 25. And I'm sure that if she was around today, she wouldn't be saying that. Okay. Now, that you look at the genius of that, that allows that woman then to not hold on to a mom and glorify everything she says, but put it into a different context and own it. And that's the sort of thing I'm talking about. Well, you can't all be geniuses like Erickson, but certainly in coaching and therapy and counseling, you do need to understand those, because if you just go head on, defenses go up. I mean, when people came to me to quit smoking, for example, my first question is, why the hell do you want to quit? Because I know that everyone else has said, oh yeah, you need to quit. You know, it's going to give you cancer. That doesn't matter what you think. I got to change his thinking.
Mm-hmm. No, I definitely agree. I want to go back to the families real quick, because I guess the majority of my question was not just, you know, how you communicate, you know, and it's different in families as opposed to customer service. But what about when, you know, you meet somebody, you fall in love, you usually may not meet their family initially. You know, but then, you know, 6 months in, you meet the family, and your family, maybe you're a single child, you don't have all these siblings, you're not used to communicating with anyone. And then maybe your spouse's family, he has 12 brothers and sisters, and everyone yells and everyone screams. How do you do it? How do you work it out strategically so that everyone gets along?
Yeah, and that's an exceptionally good point. And so one of the things that we're talking about here is the role that you play in a family. Now, when there's a lot of kids, they're all fighting for their own. You know, if there's fewer kids, it's still the same. But the sort of roles that people play as either the enforcer or the peacemaker or the caretaker, and those roles that you play in your family sort of lay the foundation of how you're going to interact with other people for the rest of your life, right? And so it's really important to understand that and step back and say, is that really what I want to do, or do I need to change it, or at least change it in different situations? Mm-hmm. I grew up, my dad was a very stressed out guy. He was a great guy, but he could be very stressed out. And I remember from like 3 or 4 years old thinking, oh, what sort of mood is he in? I better not say this and I better not do that. You know, and assess him and kind of be the peacemaker and be a nice guy. And even though I realized I was doing that in my teen years, it took me probably another 20 years, some as a psychologist, to realize that's not the way I want to relate to people. And one time I was counseling an alcoholic, and his boss was there, and I said, well, you need to do this. And the boss said, oh boy, you are being really harsh. And inside, secretly, I was going, yes, finally, I can actually say what needed to be said, you know? So I do think we all have that. What we're brought up in is in our critical formative years is going to shape how we talk. But that doesn't mean that's what you have to do for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of people, that is what happens for the rest of their life.
I agree. It reminds me, my father and I have actually had this conversation where he has his two brothers are older, and he has two sisters who are younger. So he's the middle child, and all his life, he fell in the role of the peacemaker of everyone. Can we just get along, play together, play nice? And, you know, but as a father, as a parent, you know, I'd be like, Dad, you can't be the peacemaker. You have to be the enforcer. You're the dad. You have to say, you know, no, yes. You know, but all his life he had been the peacemaker. So now it's something that I work with him on to be a little bit more of the enforcer.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's tough in parenting because there's all sorts of roles you do have to play. And one of them is enforcer. And we're talking about trends in society. And one of the things that I think is really important is to understand that there are boundaries to compassion. Mm-hmm. Part of it is the conventional media really like to divide people and love stories where there's a horrible victim and a Hitler-esque, you know, person on that side. They love those stories. But that's not helpful. Unquestionably horrible things happen to people. That's not the point. And I want to tell you the story. I'm working with a great guy, a military physical therapist, who had to find different ways of treating combat injuries when they were coming into him in Germany during the Iraq-Afghanistan issues. And he was able, because he was sort of outside the conventional medical system and there was a congressional requirement, can we treat these people differently? Mm-hmm. He treated them differently. So there's a great story. I've got a picture of the guy. He's sitting on a bed. He's lost a leg and he's lost an arm. Yeah, and his arm isn't that much better either. So Jeff talks to him, then he stomps on his foot and he kicks him in the leg. And the guy, if he wants to, and Jeff says, well, wait a minute, I stomped where you don't have a foot and I kicked you where you don't have a leg. Just because you expected your pain, your brain gave you pain. So he said, come on, let's go for a walk. And the guy says, Doc, perhaps you can see, he's very resistant, very resistant. Jeff says, come on. Eventually, he takes him for a walk. They walk around the ward. Guy sits back in his chair, looks up at Jeff and says, so when am I going to run again? And in fact, after he got a prosthetic leg and a few weeks later, he was back running, right? And it's so easy for us because there are horrible things that happen to us is to just feel sorry for people. I've spoken to a lot of these people who've lost limbs and what have you. The last thing they want you to do is feel sorry for them. Don't make me feel that I'm less just because I don't have a leg. I can run further than you can, you know? That in the media, I think, has changed that perspective to, here's a great story where we can divide, you know, one person against the other and to put a moral barrier down there. And I think there are boundaries to compassion. I think compassion is about empowering people, empowering them to be the best they can be, regardless of any situation.
Yes, I agree. I believe that compassion is the highest form of love. To be able to look at someone and say to yourself, there for the grace of God goes I. But I also don't like to go so far into compassion that you make excuses for people. And that's one of the reasons why I love being a talk show host and speaking to so many different people, because when anyone comes to me and they say, Sharifa, I can't do it because of this. I can't do it because of that. I can't. And I'm like, well, I can show you an interview. I can show you a guest who has done it. They've done it in a similar situation. No one has exactly, you know, cookie cutter, copy and paste, the same situation. But if you give me any topic from cancer to domestic violence to, you know, health, brain aneurysms, accidents where these people shouldn't have walked away, there's somebody who's been in a similar situation and they use that situation as an opportunity to succeed and then reach back and help other people do the same thing.
Absolutely. And that's what life really is about. It's unfair. There's no question about that. We try to mitigate as much of that as possible, but it's never going to be completely fair. It's not perfect. In fact, interestingly enough, in my career, when I was still in the UK, I treated a guy who was actually a very well-known in the field of self-help. And he was in his 40s. And do you know what his problem was? He had such a comfortable life up to that point. He had never had to deal with anything at all. And now he did, and he didn't have a clue how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Right? He didn't have a clue. And so it is about adaptation. It is about, how do I make the best of this? Mm-hmm. What is this direction for me? Right? And mm-hmm. I think that's so important. And that's what helping people really is about. You're right. Compassion can be very tough. You know, if your kids are doing things they shouldn't be doing, you need to tell them you can't do that. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean you don't love them. Oh, and I do want to tell you that one line because it's so influential when I tell it, people. Mm-hmm. You know, we get into binary thinking and we think it's either this or that, which is way too simplistic. Mm-hmm. But in the movie War Horse, I don't know whether you remember that movie, but it was about a guy and his wife, and they were living in a farm in the early 20th century, and they were really struggling, almost evicted. And he goes and buys a horse, which isn't a very advisable decision. And his wife is really mad. And he said, oh, please don't hate me. And she comes up with what I think is one of the best movie lines ever. She says, I might hate you more right now, but that doesn't mean I love you less.
Oh, that is so beautiful.
Isn't that beautiful?
It is.
Because it's so easy to get angry. You know, people do dumb things or get angry and what have you. But you put that in context and perspective. You know, mm-hmm. what doesn't mean I love you less. Just as with your kids, hey, I'm disciplining you. It doesn't mean I don't love you less.
Yes.
It just means this is, I think I'm doing the best for you, even though you don't like it right now.
Yes, but you can also adapt and change in your way that you discipline. That's what happened for me, because I grew up in a generation that was really big on discipline. So I believed that, you know, I don't believe in spanking kids. You know, my daughter and I joke about it all the time. You know, my daughter will be 27 June 1st. But, you know, all these years she gets, you know, she starts talking. I'm like, I'm going to go get my belt. She's like, you don't even believe in spanking kids. I'm like, I'm about to change my position. I'm about to admit I was wrong. You know what I mean? Because kids mm-hmm. will take you to that brink. Mm-hmm. But I never wanted to do that, because then to me, I felt that the message I gave them was that the only way for them to be disciplined or to learn was through a physical way, you know? Right. And so I stepped back and I said, what do you want them to know? And my if you ask my kids, they're 24 and 27, they'll tell you the same thing. I say, what is mama's one line she tell them? And I tell them, life is about choices and consequences. That's like my discipline. Like, this is what you're doing. People who do this, this is where they wind up. People who go to college, this is where they wind up. You know, pick, choose. Mm-hmm. You know, because mm-hmm. your life isn't about you. It's not about me. So whatever choices and decisions you make,
that's right.
it's going to be your life.
That's exactly right. I have an autistic son from a first marriage, and then I have another son. So I have my experience of fatherhood really spans the spectrum. There's a good example from my own parenting with my wife. My son, my second son, was really into the ROTC program at school. In fact, he's a captain in the Army now. He had a problem because he was the cadet commander 1 year, but he still had a driver's license that would only allow him to drive, you know, in daylight hours. So what have you, but sometimes he was late at school after dark or drove before. And he, you know, his view was, well, you know, all the kids, they drive at night anyway, it doesn't matter. I said, no, you're not driving. That's against the rules. You got to find another way to do it properly. But no, you're not driving, you're not allowed to. And so he went to the commander, who wrote a note for him, and he took it down to the DMV, and they said, okay, you're allowed to drive at night. Okay, do it the right way, right? Do it the right way. And that's, as parents, that's a terrible responsibility, but it's an awesome responsibility, because you're right. You're not getting them to lead your life. You're training them to lead their life.
Mm-hmm. Right. But the information as a parent and the knowledge you gave him as a parent was something that he will be able to use time and time and time again. It was a lesson that he learned about, like you said, doing it the right way. But it also gave him the idea, the knowledge that there's more than one way to go about something. And so often we get so stuck. Like one of my favorite things that I love to discuss when people tell me, they go, well, Sharifa, the only way to do this is, and how do you know that's the only way? Like you've accepted as fact that this is the only way. But I believe, you know, in almost every instance that there's a million and one ways to approach that situation.
Absolutely, absolutely right. Again, because of the brain's need to conserve energy, it looks for the simplest ways, but those are the problems when we get stuck in simple ways of thinking and conventional stereotypes, myths, and all of that. And, you know, that's what we need to challenge, really. And cognitive neuroscience shows us that we all do that. We just need to be more aware of it because it does track. In the end, you're the one who suffers. Right. You know, if you think there's only one way of doing something, well, you're probably not going to be very successful. Mm-hmm. Right? It's as simple as that.
Right. But even with your son in that example, if he would have taken the easy way, if he would have taken the simplest way would have just been to hop in the car and then keep driving and then hope and pray to God that you don't get caught. Right? But exactly. He had to take the additional energy to have a discussion with you. He took the additional energy to go to the captain and get the note. Then he had to go to the DMV. You know, he had to take these additional steps that might have seemed like more work. But what happens is, in the long run, if he'd have got pulled over without the license and the ability to drive, what would have happened then? So often what Absolutely. We do is we try to take the shortcut. And I'm weird, Dr. Rankin. I tell you, the people who know me know that I don't take shortcuts. Like even when I'm driving, people say, well, if you get off on this street, nope, I stick to the tried and true, the straight and narrow. I love to be on let me just go the straight way, you know, yeah. Because sometimes you try to take a shortcut and wind up taking, you know, some course that'll take you so many different places.
No, absolutely. And that's true, not just driving, but in general, you know, we look for the shortcuts, but, you know, it's about learning process, I think. It's about establishing the process of the right way of doing things. I had an interesting guest recently on my podcast, Handout to Think, talking about environmental change and stuff. And he said 95% of these environmental projects, revitalization projects, fail. I said, well, why is that? He said, for one reason, they have a plan, but they don't have a process.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's a really good motto for life. Have a process, not just a plan. Anyone mm-hmm. can come up with a plan, put it down on paper. Yeah, great. So what? Mm-hmm. Have a process. And I think I thought that was great.
I think it's genius because it reminds me of a conversation I have all the time. I talk to entrepreneurs because entrepreneurs believe for some reason that their whole life, their whole day, all they're supposed to do is put out fires. That's like an entrepreneur 101. All your day, all you're going to do is put out fires. That's what entrepreneurs do. And I always tell them, no, that is so far from the truth. You are not supposed to spend all day, every day putting out fires. You're supposed to have an occasional fire. An occasional something, you know, occasionally something happens. But what it tells me is if all you're doing is putting out fires, you don't have processes and procedures in place. You're just kind of running willy-nilly, making things happen. And that's why you keep having fires, because you haven't set a way this is supposed to go.
Right, right. And also the assumption that to be productive, you've constantly got to be, you know, thinking, processing. Some of my most productive moments are when I go out for a walk or a jog and I'm out for an hour and I come back and I've suddenly got some great ideas that I need to explore. You know, if I was, quotation mark, putting out the equivalent of my fires, that would never happen. It doesn't happen in that brain state when you're processing and processing. It doesn't happen like that. And that's another thing that we need to understand, and we have as technology's got better. We need to be good at all the brain states, not just processing. We need to be good at relaxed wakefulness. You know, we need to be good. We need to be good about stopping and letting our experience and our environment come in on us rather than trying to interpret it and impose on it. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to do those things. And some companies have understood that, especially ones that need creativity. But which company doesn't need creativity?
Yes, in some form or fashion. I mean, because that's the creative ideas are what's going to sustain you. Because once you become stagnant, then, you know, you lose the interest from your following, from your customers, and you have to continuously recreate something. That's one of the things that I always talk about with my team. You know, I do marketing and PR. And so if you're going to be in this industry, it's one thing to be able to sell something once. That's it. That's easy. Everyone can do that because I just got these wonderful new glasses, right? Everybody knows their glasses. But what happens when you need to be creative and create a new marketing campaign? They're glasses. You can't, you know, they're never going to be more than just glasses. So how can you spin this story to make it interesting, exciting, creative, and new time and time and time again? That's a skill. That's a gift that if you have that, you'll be very successful.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And that requires stepping back and having the time to just let go. And, you know, some of the most creative ideas in the world have come when people weren't thinking about it. You know, they were just woke up in the middle of the night and had an idea, or, you know, were on a walk or whatever it was.
Because I get all of my best ideas at 3 a.m. I don't know why. I'm asleep. They come to me. And what's bad, though, and this is me learning myself and learning about life, is that I've learned to not announce them at 3 a.m. because I used to do that. Like, I had this idea. This is what I want to do. And then I announce it. I tell the world. And by 8 o'clock, I'm like, no, I don't really think, you know what I mean? I don't even know if that's going to work. So now I flesh it out. I plan it out. I build it. And then I announce it.
Yeah, no, and that's where, and as a writer, of course, you do that all the time. You know, oh, wow, this is awesome. I write it out, and you go look at it the next morning and say, what the heck was I thinking? It doesn't make any sense at all. But that's okay. That's the process, and that's fine. You know, it isn't a waste. It's part of the process if you don't do that.
Yes, so you have your hand in almost 50 books. Yeah. How did you start your first book? How, why, where, when? What was that like for you?
Well, it's interesting because I didn't start in high school. I was, you know, I liked to write, and if you'd asked me what I wanted to do, it would be, you know, I'd like to be a writer. But back then, that wasn't really much of a career. You know, found my way into psychology, and that became my career. And as I was going through my career, I thought, well, yeah, writing a book, all the important things have been written already. And but then I realized, no, some people haven't been exposed to them, and they haven't been written in a specific way. So don't do that. So I started writing books, you know, psychology books and things about wellness and health. I had a great mentor at the time, a lovely woman who was sort of my agent, and she told me, Howard, you don't have to tell me everything you know about a subject in a book. So that actually was helpful and very good advice and very relevant, even more so today. And so, you know, I started writing my books and then sort of got into working with other people. You know, one of the first projects as I decided to move out of more of the coaching, psychology, therapy world into the writing world, it was a great project. This guy reached out to me and said, he was a very successful banker, and he had a great story to tell about business. And he was obviously very successful. I think he was the youngest vice president at one of the major financial companies. Great guy. And he reached out to me, and we started, and telling me the story. And after like 2 weeks, he told me that he'd actually been diagnosed with MLS. Not MLS. What's the condition? Well, it was something very similar to that. I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact condition. But he was doing fine. But as we progressed and we were working on the story, he started to decline a lot. And his wife got on and said, we need to finish this book as soon as possible. And so we managed to get it done. very excited. He was excited, and he died the next day.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And just to be able to help this man tell his story, leave a legacy like that, was so important to me. That's sort of what I'm about. And it just really encouraged me to do more of not just my own writing, but help other people write their books too.
That is so beautiful. Now, Dr. Rankin, we are coming down to the last few minutes of the show. And what I love to do at the end of every show is just simply allow my guests the opportunity to speak directly to the audience, to everyone who is watching this show live, as well as everyone who is watching it in the archives, and simply let them know what you want them to take away from your appearance here today.
Well, great. First of all, again, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been an honor, and it's been great. I think I want people to understand that wisdom really comes from virtue. That is the conclusion that I've come to from my book, I Think Therefore I'm Wrong. That when you're acting out of virtue, whether that's humility, compassion, love, respect, kindness, that's when you have wisdom. And a lot of the time, we live in a very complex world, we don't have that. So just take time to understand how the thought process goes, both yours and other people. And certainly if you want to be more effective, try to reach out understanding other people rather than just spouting off yourself. I think that's, if you want to be effective, if you just want to spout off, just spout off, that's fine too. But I think, you know, again, wisdom comes down to the virtues, which every great person of the past has told us.
Mm-hmm. I like that. And it reminds me, like I'll say to certain people, and this, we're all working on our communication, you know, and I think it's great in relationships, especially when somebody's going through something, to say, okay, do you want my opinion or are you just venting? You know, so it's like,
right,
when you
exactly.
say, do you want to spout out? Like you got to be kind of be sure and clear on what the person is looking for in that moment, because sometimes they just do want to just spout off. But
yes.
That is wonderful. Where can people pick up your books or learn more about you?
You can pick up my books on Amazon. If you look up Howard Rankin on Amazon, you'll see some of my books. Certainly the most recent ones are there for sale. And if you're interested in the I Think Therefore I'm Wrong concept, I do have the website, ithinkthereforeimwrong.com, which talks a bit about the book and the concepts. And I also have a general website, drhowardjrankin.com. And you can find me on Facebook. And I also do the How Not to Think podcast, which you can find on most platforms.
I love it. Sounds interesting. How Not to Think podcast. Have to check it out. Dr. Rankin, I appreciate you so much. I want to thank you for being today's guest on this very special episode of the Roundtable Talk Show. And I also want to thank everyone who tuned in to watch this show live, as well as everyone who was watching it in the archives. But as always, please don't just watch the show. I appreciate you watching. I appreciate you sharing the show, but support our guest. Our guest is here this morning to support you, to give you his journey, his advice, his strategy. So please support him. Visit his website. The website link is in the Facebook post. Follow him on social media. Reach out to him. Send him a message. And when you do, please let him know Sharifa Hardy says hi. Now, if you're interested in more ways that I can help your business, or maybe you want to be a guest on the Roundtable Talk Show, please visit my website at asksharifa.com. Until tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. Pacific, everyone have a safe and a blessed day. Bye now.